Well, we're picking up our study in 1 Corinthians tonight, and we are in the 8th chapter. So if you want to open up to 1 Corinthians chapter 8. 1 Corinthians chapter 8, we'll do our best to cover the whole chapter here tonight. So as we come to this 8th chapter, we come now really to the next issue that Paul takes up with the Corinthians. And that is the issue of eating foods sacrificed to idols. And even more specifically here in chapter 8, the issue of those who were participating in the cultic meals offered in the idols' temples. Something that certain ones among the Corinthians insisted that they had a right to do because of their knowledge and freedom. So Paul's instruction on this issue begins here, but it actually runs all the way through the first verse of the 11th chapter. You know, it's important when we're reading our Bibles and studying our Bibles to try to, you know, get the flow of the arguments and the thoughts that the authors are laying down. Sometimes we just, you know, because the Bible is broken up into chapters, we just sometimes assume that, you know, the thought starts in the first verse of a chapter and then it ends in the last verse of a chapter. And then when you move on to the new chapter, you move on to a new subject or a new thought. But that's really not the case. Sometimes one thought or one issue will run for several chapters. We saw that in the first four chapters of this epistle to the First Corinthians. You remember perhaps as we studied there. And then, you know, we've seen that all the way through. So now he's picking up on this new issue. Remember the Corinthians and Paul. Paul was the father of their faith. He was the one who founded the church. He was the one that led many of them to Christ. But after Paul's departure, through the influence of others, they started to question Paul and challenge Paul and have disagreements with Paul. And so they were writing letters back and forth, asking questions, and Paul's been addressing those issues. So now we come to, as I said, this particular issue of food sacrifice to idols. Now, this is one chapter and a topic here that in some ways, just the actual topic, has very little, if any, relevance to us here in the Western world today. Now, if you come from, say, a Hindu cultural background or Buddhist or some other animist type of a background, then this chapter would still have a ton of relevance for you. I remember the last time I taught through 1 Corinthians was when I was pastoring in London. And, you know, of course, one of the things that we had in London was a very international church. We had people from all over the world. And I remember teaching through these chapters, and I remember always trying to find some sort of cultural parallel for 1 Corinthians 8 because it just never, you know, seemed to relate, or we couldn't really connect with the whole thing of, you know, food offered to idols and so forth. But I'll never forget one time there when I was teaching in London and teaching on this particular passage. And, you know, trying to find other applications to it because, of course, nobody does this today. One of the young guys in the church afterward came up, a guy from an Indian background, a Hindu background. He said, well, actually, everything that you read about there in the 8th chapter, he said, I've experienced that in my own culture with my family. We've had all of those same kinds of struggles because of the idolatry, because of the temples, because of the ongoing sacrifices and things. So he was basically telling me that the text itself very much speaks to where I came from. And I kind of, you know, felt stupid because I just thought, no, nobody could relate to this today. I mean, they don't do this stuff anymore. Well, they don't do it in our part of the world, but this happens all over the world today. But we want to look at the situation that Paul addresses here specifically, but then we do want to look for some current contextual application for us. So let me read it to you. It's a short chapter, 13 verses. Now, concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And if anyone thinks that he knows anything, he knows nothing yet as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, this one is known by him. Therefore, concerning the eating of things offered to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is no other God but one. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we for him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through whom we live. However, there is not in everyone that knowledge. For some with consciousness of the idol until now eat it as a thing offered to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. But food does not commend us to God. For neither if we eat are we the better, nor if we do not eat are we the worse. But beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? And because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish, for whom Christ died? But when you thus sin against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never again eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. So, there were those in the Corinthian church who thought that because they had knowledge that an idol is nothing, that it didn't matter if you ate food that was sacrificed to idols, that it didn't matter if you went into the temple itself of the various idols and sat down and had a meal there. And that was their position, and that was their argument. Now, Paul starts off here with this statement. We know that we all have knowledge. Now, you could almost do it like this. We know that we all have knowledge. This was their big thing. Now, remember, these are the same people that we talked about in the early chapters who were all caught up in the whole intellectual thing. They were all caught up in philosophy and wisdom and all of that. And so the same people Paul's dealing with here. And now what they're doing is they're putting this big emphasis on knowledge, and they're saying, look, hey, you know, we've got the knowledge. And it was kind of a superiority type of a complex they had. They saw themselves as superior to others because of their greater knowledge. So Paul says, yes, okay, you have knowledge. Well, knowledge puffs up. Knowledge puffs up. Knowledge inflates one's view of oneself. And it's really true if you think about it, kind of just, you know, generally speaking, knowledge does puff up. You think of the people who have a lot of knowledge. They like to refer to themselves as intellectuals. And what they sort of mean by that is that they're above everybody else. They're smarter than everybody else. They're superior to everybody else. And their knowledge has quite often led to an arrogance. Richard Dawkins has coined a term for people like himself, super smart people, as he perceives himself to be. He's coined the term brights. And he kind of says things like, well, you know, None of the brights believe in any of this creation stuff or this Bible stuff. And so a bright person, according to Dawkins, is somebody who thinks like him, somebody who he perceives to be intelligent. So he calls them brights. But did you know that brights is not even a word? Because when I wrote brights today, my little word processor put a red line under it. That is not a word. So that's how smart Richard Dawkins is. But it's true, isn't it? And you know, it's true of people in general. It's true of me. It's probably true of you too. You know, sometimes I found myself sometimes, you know, just feeling really smart, you know. People ask me something and it's like, oh yeah, sure, I know that, you know. And then afterwards you just kind of, you know, you just, your chest kind of puffs out a little bit, you know. And, you know, and sometimes even scripturally. The other day I had the craziest experience. So this is one of those humbling moments. Some lady comes into the office and she wants to know where this Bible verse is. And, you know, Pastor Brian, can you tell her where the Bible verse is? And, oh, of course I can, Mr. Bible Answer Man. And boom, there I am. You know, that verse is in John 5:29. John 5:29? Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's right. Wow, you are so, it's amazing. Just off the top of your head, you're like a walking concordance. Yes, that's me, the walking concordance, you know. So the lady leaves. And later I see her walking to the parking lot. She goes, you know, are you sure it was 529? Because I read it. It didn't seem to say that. And I said, no, that's it. It's 529. You know, that's, no, you just got, look again. So she leaves. And I'm standing there and I start thinking to myself, is it 529? You know? And sure enough, it was not 529. It was 629. So I was off by a chapter. But I was feeling so proud of myself, you know, that I just was able to answer that just like that with the wrong answer. Led this poor woman astray. She went off. I've not seen her since then. She's probably... But what's the point? Knowledge puffs up. It does. And we get a little bit of knowledge, and it just has this tendency toward inflating us. Someone said this: the tyranny of knowledge as the basis of Christian ethics has a long and unfortunate history in the church. Once one's theology is properly in hand, it is especially tempting to use it as a club on others. And it's so true. It's just happened over and over again. So Paul is reminding these guys, because their whole thing is, hey, look, we've got knowledge. We, you know, an idol is not, that's ridiculous. Paul says, yeah, well, you know, knowledge leads to arrogance. But love, Paul says, builds up. Knowledge puffs a person up. Love builds other people up. And the whole point that Paul's going to make in this chapter is basically this, that in our relations with other people, love is to be the primary factor, not knowledge. So, love builds up. Where knowledge tends toward pride, which leads to self-centeredness, love tends toward humility, which leads to other-centeredness. So he reminds them right off the top there. But then he goes on, he says, if anyone thinks that he knows anything, he knows nothing yet as he ought to know. So if my knowledge has led me to think that I'm better than everybody else because I'm smarter than everybody else, then the knowledge I have has not accomplished what God intended knowledge to do. Knowledge isn't intended to puff us up. And of course, the great and ultimate knowledge is the knowledge of Him. The knowledge of God, if we have a true knowledge of God, will humble us. Now, you know, it's very easy to become proud spiritually. It's very easy to get lifted up with pride theologically or doctrinally. Happens all the time. And nobody's exempt from it. Now, because none of us are exempt from it, and, you know, most of us at some point are going to go through it to some extent, the important thing is that we, you know, come through it and get beyond it and grow out of it and realize that, you know, that's not the purpose of knowledge. And when a person is really growing in their knowledge of the Lord, you're going to see an increased humility as they grow and develop. Now, I think every one of us that are, you know, seriously pursuing God at any time in our lives, every one of us are going to go through a little season, however long it might be. We're going to go through a season of that kind of pride. It's almost inevitable. It's just because this is who we are. But the Lord deals with that, and he humbles us, and he shows us that, you know, this is not the way I am, and this is not the way you're to be. And that's what Paul is reminding them of here. So, you know, if you think you know anything, then you don't really know what you need to know. Jesus knew everything. Everything, literally everything. He's God. He's omniscient. He knows all things. And yet we read about Jesus that he was meek and he was humble in heart. So Jesus is our picture of how to handle knowledge. True knowledge, knowledge of God, is going to lead us to humility. Now, Paul is going to show here that love is the ruling principle. It's the ruling principle in our relationship with God and with his people. Knowledge is not the ruling principle. Now, they had their argument for eating in idols' temples, verses 4 through 6. Therefore, concerning the things, eating the things offered to idols. Paul's pretty much quoting them, but he's in agreement with them on this point. We know that an idol is nothing, and that there is no other God but one. And even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven and earth and so forth, he said, yet for us there is one God, the Father, and then on through the Lord Jesus Christ. But here's where Paul comes to in verse 7. He says, however, there is not in everyone that knowledge. You see, that's the thing that they were overlooking. Not everybody had attained to that understanding. And that's the reality that we are always going to live with in the body of Christ. Everybody's at a different place. And so these guys are like, hey, well, look, we know that an idol is nothing. It's ridiculous. It's just an image. It's just an image of stone or of wood or something. We know that there's only one God. Paul agrees with that because that's actually the case. He says, but not everybody has come to that place of being able to see it that way. And even if someone might see it that way theoretically, it's possible that they still experientially or emotionally are not at the place where they could have the kind of freedom that these guys are talking about, that they had to engage on this level. Now, as we go further into this whole thing, Paul's going to ultimately tell them that the problem that they're failing to recognize in attending these ceremonies in the idolatrous temple and in eating the food, Paul's going to show them that the problem that you're not seeing is that there's a demonic connection here. So ultimately, Paul is going to correct them and show them that in this particular area, even though they're right about certain things, they're wrong with their final conclusion. Because in doing what they were doing, Paul says you are in essence having fellowship with demons. And you can't drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons simultaneously. He'll say that later on. But right now, he wants to draw their attention to what he refers to as, or what they might have referred to as well, as that person, the weaker person. So there is not in everyone that knowledge, for some with consciousness of the idol until now eat it as a thing offered to an idol. So Paul says, you know, there are some among you who are doing this because you're sort of inspiring them to do it. But for them, they can't make the disconnect that you're able to make. Evidently, some people could just go in, sit down and eat, never think twice about it, having anything to do with an idol. But for others, they couldn't separate those two things. So when they would sit down in the idol's temple to eat, their whole mentality would be that they're right back in the idolatry that they had previously been in before they came to Christ. And Paul goes on to say that you're putting them in a very dangerous position. You're putting them in a position where they're potentially going to be sucked back into the idolatry that has this demonic element to it. And that's where Paul says to them that they're wrong in their understanding. So he says concerning this person, he says their conscience being weak, these people end up being defiled. But food does not commend us to God. For neither if we eat are we the better, nor if we do not eat are we the worse. Food is irrelevant, he says. That's not the point. The point has to do with the idolatry itself and the demonic element to it. But beware lest somehow. So this is his exhortation to them. Okay, you guys have knowledge. You know what the truth is about these idols. They're really nothing. Okay, but beware lest somehow this liberty, or you could translate this word liberty right. Beware that somehow this right of yours does not become a stumbling block to somebody else. What were they saying in essence? They were saying, hey, we have the right to do this. It's our right to do this. We've got freedom. And you know, there's a lot of that going on today, isn't there? I mean, that's going on in our culture radically. Everybody feels like they've got a right to something. And so, heck with everybody else, I got a right. And my rights are superior. And all that really matters is that, you know, I get to experience what's you know, justly mine because of my rights. It doesn't work that way in the body of Christ. In the body of Christ, we're going to be called over and over again to suspend our rights for the benefit of somebody else, for the sake of somebody else. And so that's the warning that Paul's giving here. He says, beware lest somehow this liberty or this right of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. See, we have to watch out for other people as well. We can't just be thinking about ourselves. We're part of a family. We're part of a community. And I have an obligation to the larger community. And so the things that I do, I have to think in terms of how is this going to affect somebody else? And if I'm knowingly and willingly doing something that I know is going to potentially stumble somebody else, I can't do that. I've got to stop doing that. So he says, for if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? And because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died? See, Paul said, this is serious stuff that Paul's talking about here. He says to them, he says, you know, when you go sit in those idols' temples, and here are these others that, you know, for them, they're still struggling. They're still trying to work through this, but yet they see you there, so they kind of get emboldened. And they, well, you know, if they can do it, I guess I can do it too. But they can't do it. They can't handle it. You see, that's the thing. You might be able to handle certain things that other people can't handle. And there might be things that God has given you liberty to indulge in that other people don't have that same liberty. The problem is a lot of times we just want, you know, our liberties to be everybody else's liberties. And if they're not agreeing with us or, you know, participating in it, we kind of look at them and say, you know, you shouldn't be like that. You know, loosen up. You're legalistic. You know, you can't be that. We can't do that. People do need to grow. People do need to sometimes loosen up. People do need to come out of legalism, of course. But the wise thing is to let the Lord bring them along in time. Because you never know why they have these kinds of things. Some people have passed, and they have in their background things that if they were to go in a certain area where you have a freedom to go, it could be a trap for them. It could ensnare them in sin once again. And Paul goes so far as to say that the weak brother, because of your knowledge, the weak brother perish for whom Christ died. He's talking about somebody who does something that they really, in their conscience, don't feel that they should do, but because somebody else that they look up to does it, they go ahead and do it, and then they end up getting sucked back into sin. And Paul goes so far as to say them perishing. Man, talk about serious. That's about as serious as you can get right there. So as we look at this, we have to realize that we're not just responsible for ourselves. We're responsible for others as well. And love thinks of the other person, and love forgoes one's own rights. Love says, you know, yeah, I have a right to do this, and I know that this isn't an issue or really a problem, and I have freedom in this area, but my friend over there doesn't. So for his sake, I'm not going to do it. Or that other person doesn't. So for their sake, I'm not going to do it. But look at these words for a second with me. Look at what Paul says here. He talks about a stumbling block. As we've already said, he uses the word perish. And then he says sin against the brethren. And then he says sin against Christ. Now again, going back to their situation, they were all puffed up and proud and, hey, we can eat in the idol's temple. What's the big deal? We know that there's no such thing as idols. They had a good theological argument for what they were allowing. Paul said, your argument is right, but your heart is not right. Because you're not considering your brother. You're not considering your sister. You're not considering the weaker person. And he says, when you do that, what you end up doing is you are sinning against the brethren, and you are sinning ultimately against Christ, whose people they are. So this is where we see the application. So how do we find application for our cultural context? Because obviously we don't have the exact situation, as I said earlier, unless you come from a background where you have these kinds of things still going on. But in the West, this type of idolatry was eradicated centuries ago. But it's the application is really in the principle. Love for others trumps our individual rights and freedoms. That's the principle there. Now, let me say this. This isn't the kind of thing where we have to walk around just being totally paranoid that, oh no, I'm going to offend somebody by, you know, because, you know, some people get offended by anything, don't they? Some people can easily be offended by things that they shouldn't be offended by. And this is not to put us in bondage to people's hypersensitivities about things. So, you know, if it's somebody like that with, you know, that just gets stumbled over everything, hey, brother, I'm stumbled over those shoes you're wearing, you know, I think they probably, you know, they just look too cool and I don't think you should wear cool shoes, you know, or, you know, people can come up with some really crazy, you know, I'm stumbled over your hairstyle, you know, it just really, no, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about real things, serious things. So don't think that that's what we're referring to here. But we're talking about things that potentially can really harm people. And we're talking not about people who are kind of neurotic like that. We're talking about people who really have serious spiritual conviction over things. And like I said a moment ago, sometimes our inclination is to try to talk them out of it. Like, hey, you know, you shouldn't feel that way. That's stupid. You know, that's immature. In some things that might be okay, but you know, there, like I said, there are sometimes some serious issues, and there are backgrounds and a past that a person has that you might not even be aware of. And if people have convictions over things, it's really important that we just, okay, hey, you know, if the Lord's put that on your heart that you're not to be involved with that or associated in anything like that, then hey, I want to support that, encourage it, facilitate it, do whatever I can. to make sure that I'm not a hindrance in that area. So the principle is love for others trumps our own individual rights and freedoms. Secondly, never seek to persuade people away from their personal convictions, even if you don't share them and they seem to be rooted in spiritual immaturity. God will bring them around in time. And be careful not to do things that might embolden others to go against their convictions and perhaps end up back in sin. See, that's what we have to watch out for. So I don't want to be in a place where I'm doing something that some other person says, you know, wow, I guess I can do that, even though in their heart they don't feel like they can do it, but then they go ahead and do it, and then, you know, it creates a problem for them. Now, you know, we sometimes talk about gray areas. Areas where the Bible doesn't really speak so much. And, you know, I used to preach on gray areas years ago. But, you know, the more I thought about it, and the more I studied the Bible, I began to realize, you know, some of what we call gray areas are really truly more cultural kinds of things than they're really biblical issues. You know, there aren't too many gray areas in the Bible, really. You know, the Bible's pretty black and white. You know, it tells you, you know, this is sin and this isn't sin. And so I don't really espouse too much the idea today that there are gray areas. It's just that there are different things that culturally for Christians, and even in the United States here, you have a number of different Christian cultural kinds of settings. You know, there are some Christians that are, you know, they're very much convinced that a certain dress code is necessary for, you know, attending church and really showing God you're serious about your faith and so forth. I was talking a little while back to a young guy, 17 years old, who he's had a rough time in church and he's kind of been disillusioned. And he came here, he was visiting here from out of the country, actually. He came here and he went to our high school ministry on Wednesday night and he was just absolutely blessed. He had such a wonderful time. God really touched him, really connected with the kids over there. And on that following Sunday, his dad wanted to attend another church. He attended a church up in Los Angeles and he went into the youth group there and the kids in the youth group were wearing suits and ties. And it freaked him out. He's like, yeah, because he kind of came from something like that that really, you know, it was really devastating to him, the stuff that went on there. And, but you know, that's a cultural thing. Now, some people would say, no, if you really want to be spiritual on a Sunday, you got to wear a suit and tie. I don't think so. I don't believe that for one second. I do wear a suit and tie on Sunday morning, but not because I'm trying to be spiritual. But you know what I mean. So you get these, there's a lot of variation and differences within the Christian cultures, even in our own country. And so for some people, there it's very rigid. You know, you can't, you know, if you go to a movie, that's questionable. In some cases, it's even sinful. If you go to, you know, a bowling alley, or, you know, if you had sat down and, you know, had a card game with some buddies or something, or that stuff could be, some people see that as, you know, that's worldly. But these are really more cultural kind of things. They're religious cultures, but they're cultural. The Bible certainly doesn't say that. It was back in a certain period of time, though, where those things were associated with, you know, gambling and nightclubs and loose women and all that. So some well-intended Christians came along and said, well, you know, we don't want to get anywhere near that, so we're going to put up, you know, these barriers to make sure we never even get close. Kind of just what the Pharisees did back in the days of Jesus. So anyway, as we're talking about this, we have to be careful. This is my point. We have to be careful that we're not confusing cultural differences with truly biblical and spiritual issues. Because a lot of times that's really what it comes down to. So we have to be on our guard. But in thinking about this and thinking more in the just in regard to the idea of stumbling. And this is one area that I think we need to have a good perspective, and we need to be wise, and we need to be sensitive. And that is in the area of the use of alcohol. So that's the one connection I'm going to make tonight. It's in the area of the use of alcohol. Now, I know a lot of younger Christians today who feel like they, you know, they kind of grew up in homes where they were restricted, and, you know, they're kind of legalistic environment. Their parents were too tough on them. So one of the things that they have decided to do to kind of spread their wings and show their independence, and that, you know, they've decided to go out and, you know, have a drink here or there. And okay, I understand that. And as I look back at raising our kids, I think, you know, we probably were a little hard on them. We probably were a little tough at times. We probably were a little unreasonable, and we probably were a little legalistic and all that. So, you know, I get all of that. But I also think about this. I think, you know, a lot of these Christian kids that I know, they're not really kids now, they're young adults, but a lot of them that I know that are kind of experimenting, doing a little bit of this today, you know, what they didn't have, what they don't know anything about is the real devastating effects of alcohol, because they didn't have that as they grew up. They grew up in Christian homes with parents who didn't get drunk and beat each other up and stuff like that. But you see, we, my generation, many of us, that's the cultural background that we came from. That's the background I came from. And I was fist fighting with my dad on Christmas Eve because he was so drunk, you know, he just wanted to have a fight. So that's just what we did. And on you know, my dad's side of the family, all of his brothers, they died before they reached my age right now. All of them did, of alcohol-related diseases. Their families were destroyed long before they ever died. And it was all due to alcohol. You know, we talk a lot about drugs and the effects of drugs and the damage of drugs, and certainly drugs are horrific. But you know, alcohol is just as deadly. It's just as destructive if not kept in check. So, you know, this is an area where I think we need to be wise. I don't believe that as a Christian you can't have a drink. I don't think the Bible teaches that. I know some Christians want to insist that that's the case, but you can't prove that biblically. So I'm not absolutely insisting on that, but I am saying that we need a ton of wisdom. We need to realize the potential destruction that can be there if this ever gets out of control in anybody's life. And finally, we need to keep in mind that there are other people that have come from that background and come from that world. And for them to sit down and have a drink, they're just transported right back in their heads, just like the guy in the idol's temple. He can't sit in the idol's temple and eat the meat without thinking of the idol. Some of these people can't sit down and just have a beer without, there they go, in their head. They're right back where they used to be. They're right back to where they came from, and they're going to head back out and do that again. And that's where we have to be really wise, and we have to be on our guard, and we have to be careful that we don't stumble somebody because of our liberty. And, you know, of course, the argument, we have liberty to do this. The Bible says, of course, that you can't be drunk. We have no liberty to get drunk. But yes, okay, for argument's sake, yes, you do have liberty to have a drink here or there. You do have liberty to do that. But don't let your liberty or your right, I have the right to do this. Don't let your right become a stumbling block to somebody else. That's what Paul says. Because when you do that, you sin against the brethren. And in sinning against the brethren, you sin against Christ. And you know, as we prayed earlier tonight, I mean, can you imagine 27 years old? Here's this young guy, Sean. He's lying on his deathbed because of alcohol. So it's not anything we want to take lightly. We want to be wise. And I do think, as I said, I think that even though it's a different topic and there is a little bit of a connection here that we can make. And so the rule is love trumps my rights and freedoms. I want to be looking out not only for my own benefit, but I want to be looking out for the benefit and the blessing of others as well. And so I think that's a good place to finish up here. And then Paul's final word, therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never again eat meat lest I make my brother stumble. That's how committed Paul was to this. He said, if it was meat that actually made my brother stumble, I would never eat meat again. So that's love, because he's setting aside his own rights and he's saying, I'm concerned about them, not about experiencing my own rights. So let's have that same mind.